Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, I will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, our topic today is bouncing forward, transforming bad breaks into breakthroughs, which is also the name of our guest's new book. Bouncing Forward offers examples and inspiration for growth and a mindful approach to dealing with suffering and finding a deeper meaning in life. Now, to share more on this, our guest, Dr. Michaela Haas, is the owner of Haas Live, an international coaching company for media, mindfulness, and communication training. She has taught at the University of California, Santa Barbara, the University of the West, and other study centers in America and Europe. Since the age of 16, she has been working as a writer and interviewer for major European newspapers, magazines, and TV stations, including hosting numerous successful live talk shows. Her message of embracing mindfulness and human values has inspired audiences of every kind, from CEOs to college students, educators to engineers, nonprofits to business leaders, and I'm confident will inspire us today. Dr. Haas, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks for having me. I was particularly looking forward to your show because I know you work with at-risk youth and families here in LA. So there is so much to talk about, you know, how to strengthen resilience when kids are young, and that's the best age to start.
Well, and I've been looking forward to it as well, because there are so many times in which when we're working with some of these young people, they talk about sort of a doom and gloom.
You know,
whatever it is that has happened has now brought on this sort of doom and gloom feeling. And like you said, it's so difficult when it starts at such an early age.
Yes.
So I've had a chance to read the book. And again, I really appreciate it. Some of the things that I love about it, I love that it is written for all of us. I mean, it is written to where most anybody who has either gone through a level of trauma or knows somebody who has can pick it up and read it and find something of value. And it's not set up as sort of like a textbook or a manual from that standpoint, but yet it has these great stories of people who have fought through and really transformed their own bad breaks into breakthroughs. And I think most of us can read it and say, okay, you know what? I think that one is very similar, or I can learn from that one, or Uncle Johnny can learn from this one, you know? So that's one of the things I really felt that I got from reading the book. So thank you for putting it together for all of us.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate you saying that, because this was exactly my intention, to write a book for people from all walks of life, because I think each trauma or setback is so individual, but actually, you know, the ingredients of a resilient mindset and what helps us get through it, I found that they are surprisingly similar. Whether I've talked to a surfer who was paralyzed by a surf accident, like Jesse Biller, or an army surgeon who was captured in Iraq, or went to the Army Resilience Boot Camp, or talked to Dr. Maya Angelou, who, of course, is very famous for her books and her activism, I found that some of the strategies that helped them are really very, very similar.
And I know that you sort of touched on about like five main areas. Share with our listeners, you know, what are the five main areas of growth that trauma survivors generally experience?
So you may be first to explain, you know, so many people know about post-traumatic stress disorder, and I don't know if everybody is familiar with post-traumatic growth, because it seems paradox at first to put growth and trauma in one word or one expression. But actually, post-traumatic growth is more common than PTSD, than post-traumatic stress disorder. And people have found that they grow in five main areas. So one is personal strength, deeper relationships with others, you kind of find out who your true friends are, mm-hmm. new perspectives on life, appreciation of life, and a deeper spirituality. So up to 90% of people report at least one aspect of post-traumatic growth. So very often it's a new appreciation of life. And so often when people come out of a hospital or out of a crisis, you know, so many people are bitching about like small stuff, like somebody's cut you off from traffic, and you come out and you say, oh, I'm glad that that's your biggest problem, because I'm glad that I'm alive. I'm glad that I can breathe. I'm glad that I notice the everyday things around me. So that's one of the most common things that people have told me.
Yeah, and right off the bat with the book, I noticed that you start right off talking about resilience. So you talk about it being a major factor in people who can grow from a traumatic experience. What's one thing that someone could do today to become more resilient in their own life?
I'm happy to answer that, but before that, I want to say that post-traumatic growth and resilience are not exactly the same. So people become more resilient after experiencing post-traumatic growth. It's one of the areas of post-traumatic growth. But it's sometimes resilient people who grow the most. And I actually found that a very hopeful notion, because sometimes the people who have the most room to grow are the ones that grow the most. So one thing I think people can do today is to make a friend and to be a good friend to others, because one thing that has become very clear in the research for bouncing forward is that nobody can do it alone. We are only as resilient as the people around us, as the people who support us. We're only as strong as our support system. And that goes especially for children, of course. Mm-hmm. So one of the most hopeful notions that I took away from my research is that even if kids have a very abusive or neglectful childhood and upbringing, if there is one person, at least one person, who stands by them no matter what and who believes in them and who loves them unconditionally, they have a very, very big chance of coming out of that experience and going on to lead a happy and fulfilled life. So that, I think, puts us all in charge, because, you know, we're the adults. And it's our responsibility to be there and to not look away and to listen and to believe and to be there for others who are going through something hard.
Yeah, and what I hear you saying is that also for us to be able to focus on that person. Mm-hmm. I think far too much, again, you know, we're focusing on the person who tells us that we are bad, or the person who tells us that we are not smart, or the person that is not being supportive. And yes. and I love the fact that you said, you know, find that person, bond with that person who is there for us, that we know, quote, has our back, that we know is going to be there, which again takes us to that point of focus. What are we being told to focus on? Are we being told to focus on all of the things that are the doom and gloom of the world? Or are we focusing on the things that we can be grateful for, the things that we can appreciate?
Exactly, and that's exactly the focus of my book, because I'm focusing on what helps people rather than what discourages people. And, you know, very often when people go through a crisis, it's not that supportive people appear by magic, but what distinguishes the resilient people who don't give up is that they keep reaching out and they keep connecting. And sometimes it's unexpected people who show up for help, like Ann Mastin, who's a very well-known child development psychologist. She told me of one of her clients who had a very, very tough childhood. And for her, her family wasn't there for her, but she found a group of homeless women who mm-hmm. were supporting her and who were giving this girl strength. So the homeless women weren't doing that well themselves, but they were able to fulfill that function of giving that girl hope and giving her strength. And there is what's called the growth mindset. Mm-hmm. Carol Dweck at Stanford has done a lot of research research on that. And she's shown that if we believe we can grow, we will. And if we believe we won't grow, or we can't make it, or what's happened to us, it's like God-given and we can't change it, we're so much more likely to remain stuck. So that's behind the whole idea of post-traumatic growth, is to put that message out there and to show you can grow no matter what happened to you. It's possible to grow out of it.
Well, and from that quote that you just said, you know, there's something that you also bring up in the book, you know, where you say that, you know, you believe that, you know, we sort of society tend to belittle survivors, predicting that them to fail, mm-hmm. when in fact we're wired for survival. So if you can discuss some ways in which modern American society sets survivors up to fail, and my thought is this part of this whole sort of victimology, to where we're telling everybody anything bad that's happened to you, you're just a victim, you know? And it drives me crazy, because, you know, we're trying to, you know, we're sending this bad message of, well, you're just a victim, so it just happens to you, so you're going to fail. As opposed to what you're saying is let's focus on growth. Let's focus on how we can get through this and come out the other side better than ever.
Exactly, because every single trauma survivor I spoke with thought at first that their life was over, that trauma would be a life sentence, and that they would never be able to lead a happy life again. And this is just simply not true. It's really not true for anybody. And I believe for too long, you know, psychiatrists too, they focused too long on the gloomy. So there is no doubt that trauma, you know, has severe consequences. We're not saying that trauma is a good thing by any means. Mm-hmm. But what we're saying is that there are methods and ways we can use this trauma or the setback or the crisis, use it to learn something and to become stronger in some ways, to mature in some ways. And again, Ann Mastin, the resilience expert at the University of Minnesota, who's been studying resilience for more than four decades, she told me, it really bothers me that when people hear about the evidence on trauma or child abuse, they assume, oh, I must be totally damaged. And people pick up on this idea, but in reality, you know, there are many opportunities for reprogramming in the course of life. And resilience doesn't mean that we don't have any scars, but we do have the possibility of reinventing it ourselves continuously. So we're not a statistic. And especially with children, you know, for so long, psychiatrists thought that when children had grown up under certain unfavorable circumstances, that really they couldn't participate, you know, fully in life afterwards, or couldn't be successful. And again and again and again, you know, it's been shown, and we can back that up with science, that this is not true, and that a surprising number of children are able to take that experience and heal the wounds and go on to lead a fulfilled life.
And I think one of the examples of that is one of your subjects, war veteran Rhonda Cornum. Tell us a little bit about her story.
So Rhonda Cornum is fascinating because she was an Army surgeon, and as a woman, she wasn't supposed to be in combat, so she actually had received no psychological training for combat. So she was a surgeon in the first Iraq war. Her helicopter got shot down. She almost died. She barely survived with two broken arms. And she crawled out of this wreck and looked up and was faced with several Iraqi soldiers who took her hostage. Mm-hmm. They also sexually assaulted her. And they kept her prisoner in a bunker. And the thing about it was that she was utterly helpless because of her broken arms. She couldn't defend herself. She couldn't even feed herself. She couldn't even go to the bathroom herself. So luckily, the first Iraq war didn't last very long, and she was released after a week. When she came out of that experience, she said, you know what? I've learned something for the first time in my life that I experience what it means to be utterly helpless. I understand my patients better now. I've become a better doctor. I've become a better human being, a better leader, a better soldier. So she pretty much laid out these five areas of post-traumatic growth that we just talked about. But the term didn't even exist yet. So it took her about a decade to find out, there is some research being done here. And she started the Army Resilience Program. It's called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program. Because after her experience, she was wondering, well, why do so many soldiers come out of war experiences not okay? As you know, we have 22 soldiers every day who commit suicide. That's almost a suicide every hour. So what can we do to help people prepare for trauma and go through trauma and heal from trauma so that they can grow from it rather than being totally devastated by it? So this resilience boot camp was very fascinating, because one of the first things they teach soldiers to do there is to ask for help, to admit weaknesses, and not to be afraid to admit their fears and ask for help. So that really goes against this image that's been projected for so long of, you know, the strong, invincible soldier who goes through trauma and nothing can sway him, because the Army has recognized that this is unrealistic and actually fatal, and that admitting to our pain, being honest with ourselves, and not to be afraid to reach out is really the most important of all things we can do.
You know, and you bring up a great point, because, you know, although maybe the old way of doing things may have made them a better soldier, it did not help them to be reintegrated into society after being a soldier.
Exactly. And also I think it's just unrealistic, because nobody can expect themselves to be resilient in all circumstances. Even the most resilient people of all, you know, they have areas where they're not resilient. So even like Rhonda Cornum, I just told you her story, and it's amazing how she got out of that. But there were events in her life that she considered traumatic and where she broke down. So I think this, you know, magic potion that renders us like resilient against all things, it just doesn't exist. It's a step-by-step process. And Rhonda Cornum, she calls it her like fitness studio. She says life is like a fitness studio. We go to the gym to become stronger, and we even tax ourselves to develop our muscles. And she says resilience is like that. We take life's challenges, big ones and small ones, and we use them to grow. And to resilience is like a muscle that strengthens when we exercise it, and that withers when we don't exercise it. So I love that image, and I think that's so true.
Yeah, I completely agree. Now, you mention also in the book in regards to keeping a gratitude journal. Is that something that Rhonda also does as well now?
Yes, actually, they do that in the Army Resilience Training as well. They start each morning actually with meditation. Another surprising thing, you have 180 Army surgeons in their coma fatigues, and they take 5 minutes in the morning to focus on their breath and to practice mindfulness meditation. And then they go on to notice three things they're grateful for, and that's an exercise I recommend in bouncing forward. It could be big things, a promotion, or it could be small things like the sunrise this morning or a good cup of coffee. But the point is to notice it and to take a moment to appreciate it, and then to write it down, to have a tangible reminder of that. And what that does is surprising in terms of improving our well-being. This goes back to a couple of studies that have been done where students were asked to just write down anything important that happened or anything bad that happened, and another group was asked to write down the things they're grateful for. And lo and behold, they found that the group who writes down things that they're grateful for, they had better health, they improved their grades at school, and they had their overall well-being improved dramatically. Because I think especially when we're down when something dramatic has happened, we often fail to notice the good things that are still happening around us. Like Gabby Gifford's favorite song is U2's Beautiful Day, and she likes to listen to that. And that always brings back, you know, that advice, don't let that beautiful day get away.
It's a great way to start the day.
We need to find something to counteract the bleak. So post-traumatic growth is not just positive thinking or telling yourself you're happier and happier. On the contrary, it means looking at yourself honestly. But at the same time, we need to invite positivity into our lives. And sometimes we need to do that consciously, especially when things look bleak.
Well, let me share that I get up each morning and I go to what is known here in Huntington Beach as the Butterfly Park and with the dogs. And we go over early. There's a few people that also go that early. But to be there with the eucalyptus trees, right now is the time in which the butterflies are coming out and flying around you. And to be able to sit there in nature and kind of do the same thing. I'm not writing at that point, but I am going over the things that I'm grateful for before we start the day. So, yeah, I think it's great. And now I may add the song Beautiful Day to my to my repertoire. Yes.
Well, you're recharging your batteries in the morning before you go out and face the world, right?
Absolutely.
So for me, that's meditation. For a lot of people, it's nature that connects us with, you know, our true self, really, before we go out and throw ourselves in LA's rush hour in the morning.
Yes, you got that right. We're going to take a break. But I want to tell everybody out there, if you are listening, you can go to Michaela's website. It is Michaela Haas, HAAS.com. So that's MICHAELAHAAS.com. You can open up another screen. You can follow along with us. There's some great information on there as well. Now, obviously, if you're driving, you can't do this. But, you know, go ahead. We're going to take a break. Open up another screen. We'll be back in 1 minute and 15 seconds. Stay with us.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest is Dr. Michaela Haas, and we are talking about bouncing forward, transforming bad breaks into breakthroughs. Now, Michaela, in the book, one of the people that you speak about in there that you interview that has an incredible story is jazz legend Coco Schumann.
Yes.
Can you share with us a little bit about that story? Because, I literally had horripilations reading it on the back of my neck.
Coco is he's been a friend of mine for 20 years. And I met him. He's a fabulous jazz musician. He just turned 90. He still plays gigs in clubs in Germany. He says he'll quit when he gets old. And so Coco was 16 when he was deported to Auschwitz, first to Theresienstadt and then to Auschwitz. And he survived by literally playing for his life. because in this perverted world, you know, the Nazis had banned jazz, but secretly in the camps, they were actually competing for the best bands. And Coco was such an outstanding musician that they were competing to have him on their band. And so he would get extra food, and thus he was able to survive the horrible death camps. And what impressed me with him so much was that he said, listen, I could have spent the rest of my life being devastated that I was in Auschwitz and the things I've watched there and witnessed there, or I could spend the rest of my life being happy that I got out of there. So I decided to do the latter. And to have that kind of spirit and resilience after having seen the worst, it's just so impressive to me. But then I did some research for the book, Bouncing Forward, and I found out, much to my surprise, that actually Holocaust survivors have a much more positive outlook on life than their peers, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. Maybe because they have seen the worst. They also have strong, very, very strong relationships. They almost never get divorced. They very much rely on their strong communities. So again, all these things that we've already discussed are part of post-traumatic growth. We can show that Holocaust survivors very often have experienced one or more of these areas of post-traumatic growth. So again, I don't want this to be misunderstood at all to say, you know, the Holocaust wasn't extremely damaging and brutal and all of these things. But at the same time, along with the damage it has done, even under those circumstances, which I consider the worst anybody could experience, even then, people were able to find resilience and to transform that into deeper relationships and a positive outlook on life, which I think is absolutely amazing.
Well, I think it touches a little bit on what you said in the very beginning when we were talking about people who are sort of just complaining. They're complaining over, you know, they got cut off on the road, you know, and allowing this to really change their focus or ruin their day or whatever. And I think what we get out of these stories is that from people who have gone through some of these horrific things, their level of appreciation for the beautiful and the good things is really great. And they don't let something as trivial as being cut off on the freeway affect them because they've seen things that the rest of us can't hardly imagine.
Exactly. And also, you know, they never gave up. So they, most of them attribute their survival to pure luck because who was killed was often so random. But also, both Coco Schumann and Viktor Frankl, who's another Auschwitz survivor, they talk about the people who gave up. And you could tell that when somebody had given up and you knew that they would either run into the electric fence and kill themselves or they just wouldn't get up for work and then would be shot. And Viktor Frankl said, you know, even under those circumstances, even in the concentration camps, we have this inner freedom to choose our attitude, to choose our own way. And I thought that was so inspiring to think that even in the midst of the agony of concentration camps, to honor our freedom to choose our mental attitude. That's something Rhonda Cornham said also, you know, when she was helpless being prisoner of war, she said, well, I couldn't control anything. I couldn't control where I was or what they did to me, but we can always control our mind. We always have a choice on how we respond to something. And to be able to do that, even under those circumstances, that's truly commendable.
And strength is the word that comes to mind, a mental strength to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing to me. So I know that you talk a little bit about some of the same areas that I believe in so much, so I want to make sure that we also go there, which is some of the characteristics of American culture, you know, that you've observed. And again, we didn't talk about it, but you came here from Germany, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And and you've made some observations, and I would love for you to share some of them, and starting with this characteristic where it appears that, you know, we're sort of ordered or commanded to be happy, and that there's a pressure to, you must be happy, and that it may be working against us. So share with us some of the cultural differences that you've seen, and the difference in how we view happiness versus maybe Europeans or other people from other parts of the world.
So, first of all, let me say that I love living in sunny California, and I love that Californian spirit. You know, whenever somebody asks you, how are you, you're kind of obliged to say, I'm fantastic, and life is fabulous. And there's a lot to say for that, you know, for that sunny spirit. But I've lived in Europe, in Asia, I've spent time in Africa, and one thing I notice is that this obsession with the pursuit of happiness does have a downside, because so often when things go not well and when somebody is sad or upset or depressed about something, they're not only sad about what happened, but they also think there's something wrong with them, because there's a pressure to be happy. And if you're not happy, it's almost like it's your fault. Do something.
Right.
So that's where it gets counterproductive. And Viktor Frankl, the Auschwitz survivor, said that too. He said that, you know, one of the characteristics of the American culture is that one is commanded and ordered to be happy, but happiness cannot be pursued. It must ensue. And I think so often people think that there's something wrong with them when they're not happy, or that they, you know, my sister-in-law, Tammy, calls it our hurry up and get over it culture, when she lost her only child. And she said, you get 3 days of bereavement leave. And then after 3 days, you're somehow supposed to be back at work and wow, move on with your life. And of course, it takes so much longer and many, many, many years to heal a tragic loss like that. So she said, well, in other cultures, you know, there are rituals, and there is the community that comes together. And I think our emphasis on the individual ego that we focus on more here, it kind of sometimes leaves people alone, and we are afraid to be there for them when things get tough, and to listen to these conversations that can be very uncomfortable when something tragic has happened. So I do think there are some cultural differences in that, and that in America particularly, we have a tendency to lock people away who are suffering, like the mentally ill. We're not dealing with it. We just want them to go away. There are, 10 times more mentally ill people in prisons than there are in institutions that actually are equipped to take care of them. So out of mind, out of sight, out of heart, I think as a culture, I would wish to see that we make more space for suffering and to be there for people who are suffering, because the suffering is there. We don't make it go away by not looking at it.
Yeah. Now, you just touched on a pet peeve of mine as well, and that is the fact that America has the world's highest documented incarceration rate, and you talk a little bit about the law that was passed in Fort Lauderdale that bans the feeding of the homeless in the public. So
yes,
please talk about, you've sort of drawn a correlation between the two of these things. Share with our listeners what that correlation is.
So one of the people I feature in Bouncing Forward is Rashi Bernie Glassman, and he does the opposite of what most of us do. He actually he's been doing street retreats for 20 years, taking people to the streets to live with the homeless, because he realized he wanted to help the homeless, and he didn't know where to start and what would be most helpful. So he thought, well, I'll live with them for a while to find out what it's like and what they need. And one of the things that he observed the most is that as soon as you're on the street, people stop looking at you. They stop looking you in the eye. They stop acknowledging you altogether. And this law that's been passed in Florida, you know, that it actually arrested this very wonderful veteran that was feeding the homeless in front of his church, because they said it's no longer allowed to feed the homeless in public. He could do it inside, where we can't see it, but he can't do it outside for everybody to see. And that, to me, is an example of just not wanting to look at it. It's like a three-year-old who closes her eyes and says, I'm not there anymore. You can't see me anymore because my eyes are closed. So to pretend that this would go away by us passing laws like that is just ridiculous and does the opposite of what the homeless or other people who are suffering need, because the only way to get them off the streets is to connect with them.
Absolutely. And that's why I said when I brought it up, it's sort of a, you know, the numbers are staggering, and you're absolutely right. We have so many people who are being placed in jails in these private prisons rather than going to a psychiatric facility where they have people who are trained to help them.
Mm-hmm. You know? And thus we make the problem so much worse, because people end up getting incarcerated. That's not the condition where their illness can be taken care of or can get better. On the contrary, it mostly gets worse. Then they're released again. Then they end up back on the streets. So Roshi Bernie Glassman, he started a fabulous project, the Greystone Bakery, where he says, we don't bake brownie to hire people. We hire people. We don't hire people to bake brownies. We bake brownies to hire people. And anybody who walks through the door can get a job, no matter what their resume is, no matter their previous convictions. Because he found that the best way to help the homeless was to give them jobs. And for those who are not able to keep up a job, he started several projects, housing projects, hospices, and that kind of care, and uses the profit from the bakery for these projects for people who are not able to work.
I wasn't aware of that. I am so glad that you shared that, because that's something that again, that I truly believe in, and you're right. If we can employ more people, we can help give them we can give them purpose. We can give them something that they can do and that they can feel proud of. And once they're proud of that, all of a sudden everything else starts to blossom. So
exactly, that's what he found. He said, "Well, should I start another soup kitchen? Yeah, that would be helpful. But really, what we want to is to empower people." And so he has actually significantly reduced the homelessness rate in Yonkers, where he started the bakery. And he's so successful with it. I mean, you've probably, you know, Ben and Jerry's ice cream, right? So the chocolate fudge brownies in their ice cream are made by people who were formerly homeless or convicted felons. Mm-hmm. And Bernie says, I love that so much. You know, they got voted the best cheesecake in New York. And so he says, and he even delivers to the White House and to fancy restaurants. And he says, I love that so much. Here, people are voting us the best cheesecake. And they don't know that the cheesecake has been made by people the society has regarded as trash.
Yeah, that they won't look in the eye.
Yep. And Richard Gere found that, you know, his film just came out, Time Out of Mind, and he was stunned that when he played a homeless guy on the streets of New York, nobody recognized him, though he wasn't wearing elaborate makeup or anything like that. They just, because they didn't look at him. They saw a homeless person rattling his can, and nobody looked him in the face, and nobody realized that it was Richard Gere out on the streets.
Well, that speaks volumes right there.
Exactly.
Now, we've got about five more minutes. You know, you cite meditation quite a bit in your book. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting, you know, is that you cite that that there's a study that meditation caused a 40% reduction in pain intensity versus the pain-relieving drugs like morphine, in which caused about a 25% reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, why aren't more people meditating? And might And my guess would be that the reason it's not being promoted much is because Big Pharma, they haven't figured out a way to charge for meditation.
They're trying to. Actually, I think more and more people are meditating. That's, you know, I told you about the Army Resilience Bootcamp, and there are so many studies now that show that meditation works better than painkillers without the side effects, because America not only has the world's highest incarceration rate, but we also eat the most painkillers. We are world champions in that as well. And one thing about painkillers is that you cannot just numb the pain. It also numbs your joy. It also numbs the positive feelings, aside from all the other side effects. So meditation is such is a much better alternative in so many ways. But I think it takes the courage to try to be present with whatever is, because that's what meditation means, being mindful, being present, and that can be very painful. I think meditation is the easiest thing in the world, and at the same time, it's the hardest. It's the easiest because all it takes is to sit down, to focus on your breath, to relax, and at the same time, it's the hardest because stuff comes up. Stuff that maybe we haven't looked at in a while, or the pain that's there. And it takes training and ideally, you know, the guidance of an experienced meditation teacher to make it through these challenges. But ultimately, I believe we cannot grow and we cannot heal if we're not willing to look at the places that hurt. And that's where I think meditation is one of the supreme ways of achieving that awareness and that mindfulness and that healing.
Well, we've just received an email that touches on that, that has a question for you. This one reads, I was so excited to read about your many years of Buddhist practice to reshape the way we think of crisis, and I would add, in crisis. And it says, our teen group was asked if they would like to participate in a meditation practice each week as a part of regular activities. Surprisingly, they all but two said yes. At the end of the year, we asked them, of all the activities, what was the most beneficial to your life? 60% of the students said it was the meditation, and they described it as giving them more confidence and calm to handle difficult situations at home and at school.
Wow, that's encouraging.
It is. This is my question is, some religions reject Buddhism as a competing religion. So I would like to shed that label so that all people, regardless of religious affiliation, would be more receptive to this very powerful practice. One person suggested the word mindfulness. What do you suggest?
Yes, I love mindfulness meditation. There are different kinds of meditation. I also teach loving kindness meditation. But definitely mindfulness meditation is the basis. And I don't, you know, I've had this coaching company for 15 years now. And the people who come to me come from all kinds of backgrounds and beliefs. So I'm not teaching them Buddhist meditation, though my training is in Buddhist meditation. But I'm teaching them mindfulness meditation. And for instance, that's also what the Army does, because of course the Army is a secular organization, and the soldiers come, you know, they come with all kinds of different religions and beliefs. So it's certainly very, very possible to teach it as a secular activity and to take the religion out of it. Now, personally, I believe that meditation becomes much more effective when we combine it not just with mindfulness, but with compassion, also compassion for ourselves, because again, that's one of the most common and damaging feelings after a traumatic setback is feelings of unworthiness or guilt or self-blame. So I love the two components, the mindfulness and the compassion or loving kindness. But it's absolutely possible to teach it in a very secular way that anybody can relate to. And I find that it's really on the rise. A lot of businesses are employing it. The Army, we've already mentioned. And just everyday people who have maybe Christian background. So I don't think we have any competing gods here. I think...
Well, I agree.
I think Buddha and Jesus would just get along fabulously.
Very, very well put. We have an instant message that has come in, and we only have about a minute. It says, when you speak of trauma, one of my first thoughts is traumatic brain injuries that can absolutely destroy a person's memory and ability to function normally. Would your book and practices be applicable to this type of situation as well as normal life traumas? I am buying your book regardless for my own use and wondered if a second copy would be in order, if it would be helpful for my cousin who has a traumatic brain injury.
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for your interest in the book. And I do touch on that because for a while, scientists thought that the development of the brain would stop for adults. And now we know that it's always possible to create new pathways in the brain. And meditation has been proven to actually help heal brain injuries. But of course, again, it's so necessary, especially with a brain injury, to find an experienced meditation instructor. And of course, it's not as easy as just to say, I'm going to meditate my way through it, but it can help. For instance, it can help reduce, often after trauma, the amygdala is enlarged, and that's mm-hmm. partly responsible for panic attacks or anxiety that can happen after trauma. And meditation can actually physically reduce the amygdala, and there are actually physical consequences of being able to, you know, be more calm in stressful situations, having trained in meditation.
Wow, that is wonderful. Michaela, thank you so much for coming on. I would love to have you come back on because I feel like I could do another hour.
There's more to talk about. Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Absolutely. And again, for anybody out there, I've read the book. The book is phenomenal. You can probably get it anywhere, but you can go to the website, I know, and order it there as well, which is MichaelaHaas.com. If you're driving and you can't write this down, all of this information will be on our site, AnswersForTheFamily.com. Thank you, Michaela. I look forward to talking to you again soon. And please keep up the wonderful things you're doing because you're making lives better for all of us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And for everybody else out there, please, if you're listening to us through iTunes or Stitcher, please like us on that. That would be helpful. If you think that this is a subject that somebody you know would like, send them to our website to listen. If you know somebody and go, wow, you could really get benefit out of this, somebody that you know that's maybe gone through a traumatic, something very traumatic in their life, send them to our website. Let them listen to what Michaela has just told us, and I think they will also be able to get the benefit from that. Again, thank you everybody for listening. Be good humans and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.